Welcome to The Creative Shift. My name is Dan Blank, author of the book Be the Gateway and founder of WeGrowMedia.com. So the other day I was reading a quote from author Fleur Bradley, and she said this, "I would say I have at least 1,000 rejections, though I stopped counting a long time ago. My advice, surround yourself with fellow writers at the same stage as you. Successful writers have a clan to keep their spirits up." And Fleur's advice and her kind of admission here came in response to a question that author-illustrator Debbie Ridpath-Owe put out there. And she'd asked the traditionally published kidlit and YA community how many times they were rejected before they got their first book contract. Debbie is amazing, by the way. And she really put together a whole post on her blog based on this feedback. And I kind of loved reading all of the responses that she received, because to me, it really challenged the view that we have of what success looks like. So here is a response from Jillian Hoffman. "I was in triple digits of rejections before getting my agent. My first book on submission went to auction very quickly, but here's the thing. Everything since then was met with either outright rejection, lovely passes, or lost out to acquisitions. My advice, don't give up." And I feel like this is a challenging thing to hear, is this whole idea that, well, hey, if I put my first book out in submission and it goes to auction quickly, then boy, my second book is going to be acquired by someone, and then for my third book, my fourth book, that once you pass through a certain threshold, you're always going to be there. And yet what Jillian, I think I've got to now double check the spelling, is saying is that no, the first one did great, and then everything from there has been rejection. And I think that's a terrifying thing to consider, but that is reality. Here's another one from Diana Urban. "Here are my stats prior to getting my first book deal. 4 times on submission, 3 agents." Think about that. 5 editor requests, 120 plus editor rejections, 130 plus agent rejections. And then she says, "Don't wait for the industry to accept you. Keep honing your craft. Always be reading, always be learning, always be writing." And again, it's not that I share this or that I like reading this because I love the idea of talking about failure. It's this idea of encouraging momentum. And I think the momentum stops for each of us when we feel like it should be easier. Or, well, 20 people rejected my work. The world is telling me something. I should stop making a fool out of myself and just stop. And when you read this feedback from now successful writers, realize like, oh, she literally had 3 separate agents before her book deal. She had hundreds of rejections. It reminds you, this is just the work if you want to be traditionally published. Of course, you have all kinds of options because you can go to a hybrid publisher. You can do independent publishing. You can take so many different paths for sharing your work now that you never had an option for decades ago. And I think that it inherently challenges the relationship that we have with our own creative process. And I think a little too often we have this very simplistic, sentimental view of what it means to create or find success. It's not that I mind people being sentimental or simplistic. It's when you're disappointed in that process and you stop. That's what bugs me. So recently I was reading this Twitter thread from Scheme Richards, and he's been on my podcast before. And this was the tweet. He says, "I've never felt forced to do anything as an artist. If you feel forced, then maybe you should change your art. If the money is forcing you to compromise, then don't complain. Either do it or don't. It's that simple." And he had a couple responses to this, which were really interesting. And I thought that in general, it was a really good reflection on the nature of how we feel about the path of having a career as a writer or a creator. it's this idea that sometimes we say, oh, they're making me compromise. And I think one of the things Scheme is implying here is this idea of, well, no, I mean, they might be asking that, but it's up to you if you compromise. And if you do, own it. If you're compromising because it makes your path easier, that's great. Totally own that. If you're compromising because you agree with them, like, just not feel bad about it, because I don't love the idea of someone making it in their career and then feeling like they can blame everyone else or blame the marketplace. And he had a response by @FrankieZanadu on Twitter, and it said, "But I realized that if I spent all my time seeking everyone's validation, I'd never find my own voice as an artist." And I think this is that thing that we're always balancing between, which is what's my path versus what's the path that will work. And we never really always know that ahead of time, of course. We're always sometimes feel like we're going backwards and we're spinning our wheels. And to me, this is one of the magical and beautiful parts of the process. For the writers and creators that I speak to and work with, they invest themselves in this work because they want to write a novel or a memoir or help and inspire or educate people in some way. And they want to reach this ideal audience that they have. Yet they struggle with creative decisions because there isn't one set path. I just want to say this is normal. And you get to define how you feel about that process, about the path that you take. A couple weeks back, I'd mentioned that I had been doing a pretty deep dive into Quentin Tarantino interviews, because he has a pretty unique career in Hollywood, and that was interesting to me from a creative career standpoint. And I found this clip where he talks about how before he had success, he had 8 years of nothing but failure, trying to break into filmmaking. So the quote he shared was this: "Whatever success I've got comes after 8 years of nothing working out. Up until 1991, any luck that I had was either no luck or bad luck. Everything was just building up to a horrible letdown." And he shared stories of the 3 years that he spent with his own money filming stuff for a movie he was going to fund on his own. And then he looked at the film after he got it processed, and it was just not good. He talks about deals that he was working on that fell through. And year after year after year after year of this, while he worked in a video store to try to make this work, while he wrote, you know, he doctored scripts on the side, and he made screenplays that people would not buy. But then he said something really profound. He said, "When you stop asking permission and take destiny into your own hands, things start to fall into place." And for him, what that meant was to stop compromising. He refused to change even a word of his scripts while he was negotiating with studios. So it'd be pretty common for them to say, "Hey, look, we kind of like where you're going here, but can we change this or change that?" And he would just say no. No to changes in any part of the plot or any part of the characters, but even any word change. And he's very well known for being specific about the language he uses in his scripts. And the results are some very polarizing films, but it's also afforded him one of the rarest careers in all of film. He is someone who has Final Cut. And this is something that very, 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 very few other directors have in Hollywood. Usually there's committees and there's all kinds of people that are involved. And I say this, I use film as an example, because I think that sometimes we forget. If you are a writer, you have Final Cut. You get to determine what you create and how you create it. You get to determine how you will publish it. You get to determine where you will and where you won't compromise. And that's why I get so excited about this idea of there being so many different forms and paths of publishing, that you can go traditional, you can go hybrid, you can go indie, you can do something else. That you get this as a choice. And of course, there are pros and cons either way. And at a 1,000 points in that process, you might be conflicted about where your values are or what even is the nature of compromise and what is a good change and what is a bad change. But you get to change course, and you don't have to compromise ownership if you don't want to. And again, I just think that's amazing that you have that choice, because decades ago, people didn't have that. There was a system in publishing, a system in film, a system in music. You either went through the front door of someone else's system or you didn't play in a professional realm. One of the most genius ways I've seen someone doing this is from Taylor Swift. I don't know every detail of this, so this is how I understand it. But like most major recording artists, the early part of her career was right through the system, right through a music label, where she created albums and the music label owned the rights to her work. And that could then be sold. Those rights could then be sold. And that's what happened with her. Her rights were sold, and it ended up being bought by the person, the one person in the world that she thought was the last person that she wants to own the rights to her music. And you can imagine this being a horrible situation for her, her life's work being owned by someone who you desperately don't want to own it. And then she did something that was just unthinkable. She re-recorded, or is in the process of re-recording, most of, or all of, or some of her previous albums and songs, and re-releasing it. And from what I've seen of people studying these recordings, the recordings are eerily similar in terms of they sound just as good as they did years ago. It's not like you hear someone where now it's a wildly different version of these classic songs. They sound very similar, and in most cases, better. The recording process, the mix downs, the instrumentation, it's all just better. And she's releasing these, and in parentheses next to every song and every album is Taylor's version. And this is the note to her fans, that if you support her and her art, then these are the versions of the songs that you will support, because these are the versions that she owns, she controls, and she earns from. And this is just genius. When I first heard about this, I just couldn't believe it. And the more I looked at it, I was just my mind was blown at this whole idea and the effort going into it. And here she is, taking back permission, taking back control. And you get to do that, whether at the start of your career, the mid-career, later in your career, you always get to do that. And we have these options now that we never had before. And this is one of the many reasons why I love doing the work that I do, to be on the journey with the writer as they figure out their voice, figure out how to share this work, and figure out how what they write has an impact in the lives of other people. So if you're out there on your journey and feeling confused and feeling frustrated, I just want to let you know you are not alone. This is the process people go through. And I think knowing that sometimes makes everything a lot better. All right, as usual, you can email me, dan@wegrowmedia.com. You can find me at wegrowmedia.com and on Instagram and Twitter and social media at Dan Blank. Thank you so much for listening until the end.